The devil.
Oh boy.
Who is he? What is he? Hell. The invisible war. This is what we're talking about on the Grace Hour show today. We are a podcast that originates from Greater Grace Church in Baltimore. I'm Steve Androlonis. I am one of the pastors here. With me today, making, I think, his debut on the podcast is Anu Iyer. And he serves a variety of roles. He's a bass player. I know that bass players generally don't have names. See That Thing You Do, the movie with Tom Hanks. He is an operations excellence manager for the operations at our church. He does some graphic design. He's an amazing cook. His butter chicken is legendary. He's also a photographer, a videographer, all those kind of things. And for several years, he performed a role as Jesus of Nazareth in our church Easter play. And he does some things there. So did he wear a wig back then?
No, you didn't. I had hair.
You had hair back then.
Year,
okay, but now.
Each year, the hair would recede and then the hairspray budget would go up.
That probably says something about. No, it doesn't. It doesn't. But we're talking today about. This week, it is the week's theme for the Grace Hour show is the invisible war, which is, you know, what's going on behind the scenes. And, Christmas season is, you know, a most, interesting season because there are a lot of things going on. And so today we're talking about the strategy of, hell. In terms of temptation, sin, trying to distract people and get people away from a relationship with Christ. So what do you have to say to open our discussion today?
Zane preached a really good message on it. I think it was Wednesday night. Like what?
Oh, the tests and trials message from last Wednesday. Yes.
Yeah, it was really good. He said he and I, like our... Him and his wife and my wife and I, we've hung out and we've talked like, you know, budget or whatever. And he said one word. He's like, is my 401k bigger than, can it be a trial? Can it be a blessing? And for me, that's like, I don't know if he was speaking to me, but if he was, he did a big, like a great job, like just, you know, speaking right to me. Because I think when growing up, like from Saudi Arabia, where it was where I was born, and everything was like, you know, a little bit more like there was less freedom, obviously, and so that directly influenced my need to sort of maintain control over these things, you know, just the minor details in life. And as I became a more of a functioning adult here in Bible college and just in my adult life. Things that I could control, you know, I can control where I spend my money. I can control this, that, and the other. And so like when he said that, it had occurred to me that there are times when even something as simple as like, how am I spending my money? It overtakes my entire focus. Like I'm in church thinking about how do I spend my money, you know, beyond the tithe. And this, the distractions, they really are everywhere. And it's well-intentioned, you know, I as like a husband, I want to take care of my wife. I want to take care of my family. And this is one way to do it, you know, be responsible with it. But then at the same time, it's like, okay, if I nickel and dime down to this much, you know, we'll be good. You know, but this, it becomes too much. It's like, I'm taking away what God may want to do and not about the money, just in general, you know, just like I'm letting myself spiral even, you know, just in thought and in deed even. It's kind of nuts. I'm learning about it. I'm learning how to control it better.
Control the...
I suppose, okay, yeah, sorry.
Defending yourself from distraction
is
what you're
saying. Yes, that's a better way to do it. Yes, that's a better way to say it. Not control my, like, yeah, just give up control. There it is. Like, give up, let God take care of it, you know, let God take away the distraction so it doesn't distract from him, and from focusing on him, even in the church service, you know, just, I should be listening to the message and just, you know, be receptive. Instead, I'm like, where can I spend my money?
So, yeah, so that's, so this is an operation. This is a, what is it? It is a function of, of the invisible atmosphere.
Yes.
That is, like, we know from the Bible, we could quote the Bible very easily. We know that the devil is the prince and power of the air. We know that the whole world lies in wickedness. And so we know that there is an atmosphere that is controlled by beings. We don't know how this being, Lucifer, came to be distracted himself. Or distracted to himself, we should say. This is the way that I understand it from, you know, looking at the Bible and reading books about the Bible. Screwtape Letters, we'll talk about that. That's a very, it's humorous, but it's a satire, but it is rooted in this real truth. C.S. Lewis's fictional account of an older demon instructing another demon in how to tempt a patient, as they call, and get him distracted. Like, you're sitting in a church service. Mm-hmm. Here is a message that's coming that could help you in something you're going to face. And you're thinking about how much money you got in the bank. So there you are, right?
Yeah.
That's what you're saying right there.
I mean, even in the book, like, it's like, distract him with reality, or distract him with the real world instead of focusing on the spiritual aspects of life.
Yeah, that's the service that C.S. Lewis did with that book. You can talk about the real world. Real world problems are not as real, or as not as significant as they try to distract us from an understanding of, God's will being done on earth as it is in heaven. Mm-hmm. So why, the devil would do that? That's pretty much the way this drama plays out. Screwtape talking to a younger demon, and he's really, that's another theological discussion to have later. How old are demons? Okay. Well, anyway, so don't, if you've got something, if you've got something to say about that, we're not getting into the theological thing, and we must be careful to point out that C.S. Lewis's writing is a piece of fiction.
Yeah.
It's not, he doesn't claim to have, but he does have a very good understanding about how the devil's subtlety. So mm-hmm. Talk about that. You're talking about the subtle approaches to our practice of faith and the disruption of that. Hmm. Like, you gave a very good explanation there. Like, you could be thinking about something when you should be listening.
Yes. I'm trying to think of, I think when I came here to Bible college my first year, I think it was September of 2016, and I had no real, like, direction for my life. Like, some pastors from here came up to Toronto, which is where I was living at the time, and they introduced me to the idea of Bible college. I had just come out of high school at the time, so this out of left field idea to come to something like Bible college was presented to me, and I didn't know what to do with it. And so, because high school, a year of tuition was free for, someone who graduated out of high school, I said, sure, why not? Let's do 1 year. Mm-hmm. And, during that 1 year, there was so much craziness just in my life, like, my living situation, and then just even in my own mind, as, like, I guess you could say thought patterns were being reshaped. I was 19 years old at the time too, so I don't know what I don't know. And I'm trying to think and understand, like, what does it mean? Why am I in Bible college? And every year, at the end of that year, it was like such an overwhelming time for me, because I wasn't sure if I was supposed to go back to Toronto and go to college, or if I was supposed to stay in Bible college. And just, I don't know, all of my friends were back in Toronto at the time. Mm-hmm. And not that they were a distraction, but my status quo or my baseline of what I was used to was completely being rewritten. And I think at that time, there was a lot of uncertainty. And in that uncertainty, I was just yo-yoing from like, oh, I should leave Bible College. Oh, I shouldn't leave Bible College. Oh, I should go back to college. And in my thought pattern, and here's my ultimate point. My ultimate point is that I am an overthinker and I try to plan for every possible scenario, like plan this, plan that. If I go to college, okay, 4 years and then I can get a career. Or if I stay in Bible College, I don't know. Am I staying in America? Do I go back home? Am I to be a pastor? Am I to be working in a church? Like, I think even as good as it was to think all of these things through, I think that looking back, the amount of overthinking that I committed to each of these topics, and you know, it's like a branch, it's like a tree. Every thought you can have stems into 50 million different thoughts. Mm-hmm. And I would be ultimately distracted by, what about these scenarios? Like, how can I create safety net after safety net after safety net so that I ultimately will be okay, whether I stay here in America for Bible College or whether I return to Toronto and go to college and find a career? How can I just be good? And I re-listened to a little bit of the Screwtape Letters, and like, this is the kind of the strategy that Screwtape and Worm would adopt is kind of similar, where it's like, he's sat here and he's the gentleman at the museum. He's like sitting and waiting, and he's like, all of a sudden he's almost touched on what it is to be, you know, a creation of God. And for me, and I'm like, I lose sight of that. I'm like, how can I control everything, be in charge of these reins, and then be the master of my own life? And I think that was broken, obviously. And God really took charge of it. But I was very susceptible to being distracted by my own self, just like the way I've been, I don't know, the way I was, the way I am, maybe.
Well, I think it's just, I think you're pointing out to something. What is the design or the strategy? We're talking about strategy. This is strategy of taking someone out of the perfect will of God, and getting you into things that are, you know, secondary, as opposed to, you know, instead of keeping the main thing, as they say, you're trying to. Now, here's a quote from Screwtape Letters. You know, this is an instruction. The safest road to hell is the gradual one, the gentle slope, soft underfoot, without sudden turnings, without milestones, without signposts. It's like you're saying, like, you know, you overthink things, you get caught up in a bunch of things. I'm reading a book right now by John Acuff called Soundtracks, and it is talking about how using overthinking to your advantage. So it's like flipping, you're an overthinker, so this is the way you are. Maybe you could get a hold of that book. I got it from the library, the Baltimore County Library, so I didn't buy it yet. And I'm reading through it, and I'm really understanding that there are, you know, there are ways of, you know, he's talking about the playlists in your mind. And the devil would like to introduce to you a certain kind of playlist in your mind, which would keep you from thinking, you know, God's thoughts about yourself. And this is primarily, he calls it soundtracks, like you have a certain soundtrack, and your soundtrack could be, you know, you're an analytical person, so you analyze everything. I am this way. I've discovered this, you know, maybe later in life, maybe you discover it sooner in your life, that, you know, I'm over analyzing things, and I can be a person of critique. And, you know, it stems from living in a journalistic world for, you know, a couple decades. And now as a pastor, since the past 20 years, and, you know, it's slowly I've become less. And there's a statement in this book, Soundtracks, that hit me in the best way. There we go. Hit me with a, you know, just thought about, like, you know, instead of critique, curiosity. He's saying, flip the statement. You're curious about something. You're going into a meeting. You don't know why you're having a meeting. You're like maybe agitated about the need for a meeting. Mm. And, you know, you don't like change. And, but instead of being critical about what could happen, you are curious rather than critical. Curiosity is better than criticism, which means I should, the devil is trying to make me a critic. And therefore, and a critic can fall very easily into being fall into being a cynic. Mm. You start as a critic and then you become a cynic, which means your criticisms take over your frame of reference. And this is a slow slope. Mm. The devil can do this slowly in you. Like you described this scene from the Screwtape Letters where the guy is like, an art museum and he's like, maybe he's looking at one of the great works of art about the Passion of Christ, mm-hmm. you know, and then he's beginning to think about why did Jesus do that? And all of a sudden the devil punches the hunger button. He needs to get lunch. He's mm-hmm. out and all that was close, yeah. you know, yeah. all of that kind of thing. So I think that we look at Matthew 4, we look at Luke 4 and we see 40 days Jesus battling the devil. He, you know, and it's very easy, very trite maybe to say, you know, you just battle the devil based on the word of God. Now that's a very compressed situation there. And, you know, with us, it seems like and we know that Jesus lived a life of 30 some years. But, you know, a life on earth for 30 some years. And we know that the devil did try to kill him mm-hmm. early in life. And, all of these kinds of things are, you know, that compressed sense is like maybe we can get like very focused on this is the way you handle the devil. But the devil doesn't always throw things at you the way that he did. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. That was good.
I mean, just think about yourself. Okay. You know, I mean, I'm just going to take you back to when you were playing Jesus. It's like, I'm sure there were projections that came to you about what you're doing and who you're portraying.
Yeah. Oh man. It's been a while since I did that. Yeah. Yeah. But, it just came back to me that it's been a while. During that time, it was my identity would come into question. My worth in one sense, like what is the point of me? What is the point of the play? Even like big mm-hmm. picture, not just me playing the role of Jesus. Like what is the point of the play? How can it be a tool? Cause even like up to Jesus, I hadn't really performed in any theatrical production. We did do The Hiding Place the year, a few months prior.
Yeah, that was intense too.
That was
okay. That
too.
Was super intense.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I don't know. I think, my identity coming into question, my worth coming into question, that feels the way the devil may, like you said, a slow slope, a gradual slope. Mm-hmm. It's not like all of a sudden he comes out the gate and it's like, what are you doing? What's the point of this? You're terrible at acting. It didn't happen like that. I think, it was slow in the sense of each rehearsal, like, am I doing this line correctly? Do I deliver it differently? Mm-hmm. Is this the way someone will get saved if I do it this way? And I think the complexity with which that small thought can then derail your own thinking. It's like, how can I then pivot? How can I make this about me? The devil has made that entire effort about how I can best deliver a line or how I can best be an instrument from my own strength to mm-hmm. someone else's salvation. And that just is so effective, effective at completely taking away that it is God who does the work. It's not and not to say that you shouldn't do things well, but you know, the thought behind it, the motivation behind the way I do things, it could have easily become, how can I best deliver this final product, and then I can look back and say, okay, yes, it is because I said it this way, or I read this much of the Bible beforehand, or I did this, or I did that, I did my prep work. But mm-hmm. there was another time. It's not even just mental. That it physically also, like there was one year. of the play. Like I was on the cross, and I think I love looking back on this story in particular, because for a moment, for just maybe 30 minutes, I got to experience, I think, what was a fraction, like, and I do mean a fraction, like a mm-hmm. very, very small percentage of the physical anguish that Jesus may have gone mm-hmm. through. There was, like, I was on the cross delivering a line, like, it is finished, I think. And I don't know why or what, like, I said that line, it is finished, and my head exploded in so much pain. Like, I don't mm-hmm. know what happened. Mm-hmm. I think I got a terrible migraine, like, ultimately looking back. And for 30 minutes, and we still had one more scene to do. Like,
yeah,
I was supposed
to, yeah,
I was supposed to come back resurrected. I had to shower as well. Like there was like a true physical barrier, unlike anything I've experienced before at a pivotal time, like the declaration of the finished work right then and there. And then all of a sudden there's just me, like I'm in pain. I legitimately had a hard time moving. Like as the team were prepping me for the next scene, like they could tell like something was off, and by God's grace, like I was able to do it, but then just like sitting there, I think maybe the devil could have said, let's physically like derail this show completely. Uh-huh. And instead, I think what I walked away with was, wow, that much pain and anguish. And he still was willing to endure all of that mm-hmm. For me. And that was the first time I'd really experienced a physical sort of physical strategy from the devil in terms of warfare.
Yeah.
It was very it was very interesting to go through.
Yeah, I think that you're making a point there. Like you experience, like you're saying, like a small degree of what Jesus experienced. And I think that's an important point for us to understand about the one we have this relationship with, the one that we are hid with Christ and God. And the tendency is for us to minimize the extent that Jesus operated by faith in the Word. He's the Word made flesh, and people seem to think that it was just really like, you know, snap the fingers and he could make something happen. And the fact that he is God mm-hmm. and was God during his, you know, and now he's God as a glorified human being, resurrected human being. But we don't, I use this illustration a lot to describe this. Like I have a father-in-law who has the blue ticket, the blue handicap thing that he puts on the thing. He's 90 and sometimes he leaves it in my car. And like there's a temptation there. There's a great temptation. I have a privilege. I am not of that category. I can walk on my own. I could walk, you know, 500 extra steps to get to the door, but I have this privilege. Do I exercise this privilege and park in a handicapped parking spot just because I can, because I got the official designation. Yeah. And I think, you know, when we think of Jesus is living, you know, just totally God, totally man at once. And if he wanted, he said this, he gave us an indication of the power that was available to him in the garden. Now that's another very intense scene mm-hmm. for you.
Yes.
When you play Jesus, mm-hmm. it's like in the garden, we know that Jesus is really overwhelmed. He's wrestling as a human being with the pain and the question. And like, you know, imagine he's sweating great drops of blood. You had a significant, migraine, maybe mm-hmm. a moment there. And we know that Jesus could have called legions of angels to just wipe the whole thing out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've seen some forecasts, foretastes, they're called, for the next season of The Chosen, which is Passion mm-hmm. Week. And I've noticed that, that there, some of the outtakes that they're releasing to tease this next season mm-hmm. of this thing is that Judas like betrayed Jesus in order to push him to, of course, he will, you know, as soon as the right moment comes, he will bring this total glorification of his majesty and this total triumph. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't happen that way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Jesus had to operate in faith all the way through to the cross. He does forgive those. They know not what they do. He does feel the detachment. He feels totally bereft of any sense of the spirit or fellowship that he's enjoyed forever. Mm-hmm. And then he has to commit his spirit to the Lord by faith. I don't think we recognize the miracle of Jesus reaching that point where he says, it is finished. Mm-hmm. And then he commits his spirit to God by faith. He's diving into death. No one's ever dove into death the way that he is. And, you know, that's the thing that we, you know, we see that 40-day period where he just, you know, knocks the devil out with some quotes from scripture. But we know that when he's on the cross, he has to commit himself. So yeah. Jesus understands facing the devil on every level.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing that I'm trying to, I guess, common fact, you know, we will all accept, we'll all receive or experience, sorry, temptation and constant strategies from the devil. But if I, like, how would you say I fail in a temptation?
Mm-hmm.
You
know? Yep.
How do I rebound?
Yeah.
That's something that.
That comes to a question of your identity right yeah. there. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was recently, I didn't fail through a temptation, but I wouldn't say that it's still a strategy of the devil. Like the devil, like, I think had a part in it, and I made a mistake. Mm-hmm. Like it had a consequence, and I'm for a few weeks, I mean, even a month, like honestly, like my identity was in question.
Beat yourself up about it.
So much.
Yeah.
So much. Black and blue all over. And mm-hmm. I am the victim of my own beatings. You know, it's mm-hmm. just, it's such a, and then the rebound, like my wife has been amazing, like carrying me through, supporting me, you know, praying for me. And those who do know it, like, you know, they've been praying for me. And, but like, it's kind of like a, it's, I'll use the phrase seared conscience in mm-hmm. the sense that I have been marked by it. It is, mm-hmm.
You have a callus.
Yeah, a callus.
I say, it's not, your yeah. conscience isn't totally,
no.
but there is, yeah, like yeah. playing I have calluses on my fingertips from yeah. playing the guitar, what I do. So,
yeah.
you know, and they're tiny, but yeah. they, you know, I used to impress young ladies before I was married by putting out a match with my fingertip
wow.
and I got such a callus. So anyway, go ahead.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It's an unfeeling spot. You
yeah.
can get an unfeeling spot in your
yeah.
soul.
It's also like a knot in a tree, you know, like if you were to cut a tree down, you can see where the knot
yeah.
was, in the rings of the tree. And what I am still actively learning is like, if, you know, we determine a tree's age by the rings around the
yeah.
tree.
Mm-hmm.
And if we were to view life as like that spiral, our lives, or at least I'm liking the way I like to think about it, is the life goes round and round. We go bigger and bigger, and we come to a knot in our lives, whether it's a temptation from the devil, or we fall, or we stumble. And that callus, that mark, that knot, that trauma or whatever, it's still there. But a year goes by, and maybe that remnant is still there. Or it's not even a year, you know, like I this situation was not that long ago, but every now and then mm-hmm. I have these moments where I'm like, what's the point? Or, you know, just what is my worth? But I think I've learned something, so like I can go around that knot maybe mm-hmm. a little bit, and then I go again and I go again, and perhaps I've circumvented the knot entirely,
mm-hmm.
but I think that only happens by continually being aware of the devil's strategies
mm-hmm.
and then constantly seeking after God, his identity, his worth, his character, his attributes for my life, and being deeply rooted in that truth
mm-hmm.
and growing in it. Easier said than done, but
yeah. Yeah, no, yeah, let's just think about this. I think what you're saying is like, this is a very important strategy. I mean, well-employed strategy. Now, again, to quote C.S. Lewis, he says there are two extremes that we can fall into about devils. One is to disbelieve in their existence. Mm. And that's one of the great things. There's a Randy Stonehill, an old, he's in his 70s now, but he was one of the original contemporary Christian artists. And he wrote a song called Remember the Devil. And he said one of the devil's best ways is to make you think that he doesn't exist.
So Usual that's another suspects.
Thing. Huh?
Usual Suspects.
I'm sorry.
Usual Suspects movie, they quote yeah. that too.
Yeah. So, you know, so this is one thing that happens. And then the other thing is we can be totally occupied with everything's the devil, everything. The devil made me do it.
That guy,
the Flip Wilson comic character. He did a woman named Geraldine. He, you know, was a church lady, an African-American church lady. And she said, the devil made me do it. And this was always her explanation for things. It was hilarious. But this is from, you know, late 60s, early 70s kind of comic relief that were going on. But I think we don't, you know, the thing is to have a healthy understanding of the brilliance of the devil. You know, he is a brilliant being. He was created a brilliant being. He's tarnished that with a self-orientation, but that doesn't negate the activity of who he is. And this was the, you know, we read like a very clear understanding of who he is in Job 1, Job 2. And here's a man living before God, has everything stripped away from him. And it's, you know, it is at the instigation of Satan saying, you know, the kind of way that you wrap this person in bubble wrap, you know, you take that away and everything's going away. But there is something very interesting. The phrase that I like to look at in that, in both situations, the devil says something that says, if you do all of this, he will curse you to your face. Now that is a very, if you go through the Psalms, you know that the face of God is shining upon us. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I think is really of a great annoyance and agitation to Lucifer, who has become the accuser, is the fact that we still, in spite of our failure, like this is the thing, this is the thing that you need to, we need to teach ourselves when we're under this kind of self-condemnation, is like we still have a place before the face of God. Mm-hmm. Like, and the devil makes this statement and saying he will curse you to your face. And it's like, well, you know, the fact is that at the end of the story, Job does say, I used to know you this way, but now I see you. And it's like, I have a greater realization of your face. Yeah. Mm. And this is like, you know, you just, I think what you're saying, like, is like when you feel failure, when you fall into a mistake and you start beating yourself up about it, this is like, you know, the devil wants you to get this on repeat, your playlist on your repeat, not random anymore, just totally beating yourself up. You shouldn't even be doing this. There's no way. Like, you know, during the play, you shouldn't be Jesus. You're not like Jesus at all. Yeah. Of course, no one is. And then this other thing is you're doing a lot of things on a lot of different levels with a variety of things. So you are, you know, artistic people generally have sensitivities. I mean, everyone does. I mean, a person who who plugs in the wrong pipe as a plumber could send something tragically toxic into your bathtub, right? I just say that because that happened to someone in my family. There was a clog in a drain in his house and something toxic came out. So we know that that's like, you know, so everyone, I don't want to say artistic people have a different kind of projection that's thrown at them, but the devil does everything that he can to get, he knows how to push your buttons. Very good reporter watching you and, the Screwtape Letters presents this, you know, in some ways, but you know, knowing who the devil is and knowing like how he's trying to yank your chain, right?
Yeah. Oh man. What was it that you were saying? Better the devil you know.
Oh yeah, you were saying that. You said that. You said better the devil you know. Go ahead.
Better the devil you know than the devil you don't, or the friend you don't. I mean, there could be variations on this quote, but yeah, you're right. Like knowing the enemy's plans is the best way to be able to be prepared against them.
Yeah, I mean, we have that whole category of armor, and all of it's related to thinking, feeling, praying, all of those things in Ephesians. It's like these are, you know, there's like a very, Paul did a very good job of like describing things. And why is armor on a soldier? What do you think?
Protection.
Protection. Resilience. Sword, offensive, right? Mm-hmm. The shield is the thing that, you know, we deflect the things. But now, it's interesting because I grew up in Baltimore. I'm a Baltimorean. You've been, you know, like you said, you were born in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. You're of Indian descent. Mm-hmm. You lived in Canada. Mm-hmm. Like the atmospheres, mm-hmm. like the cosmic atmospheres are different, correct?
So different. Actually that... One thing that I was in Saudi Arabia until I was 13 years old, and then in Toronto from like 13 to 19. And the way the devil would attack us, me and my family in Saudi Arabia, was very different from the way we were subject to his strategy, if you will, in Canada. In Saudi Arabia, it was active persecution. You know, we had to have churches underground. But even then, like, it was like, I think the persecution also brought out this amazing, intense, you know, a really good fellowship, you know, like really, really good fellowship when you and your collective body members are just going through the same thing in the same way. It just, you have to draw to God more and more. And there are so many more stories I have about that, but in a nutshell, like it was a physical persecution there. We'd have to be secretive about the way we would go to church and have, you know, just regular body life, like going to visit people at home or even a church picnic, if you will. Whereas in Toronto, it was like the freedom of the internet at your fingertips in the most, what's the word? Unmoderated way, you know, unmoderated way. In Saudi Arabia, moderation everywhere because they're also very strict with, you know, the Islamic religion. But then in Canada, it was like everything's available to you. And it's like, here's the different way that, you know, your faith, your security, your teaching can come into question and then you can begin to doubt what is truth or... Mm-hmm. I can handle this much. Surely I can handle this much temptation, you know, as a young teenager. It's like, yeah, I can deal with that. That's fine. This much, redrawing the line in the sand this much is something I can be okay with.
Mm-hmm.
Not the case, you know?
Yeah. Interesting. I think what I hear you saying is like in Saudi Arabia, just the sense of your minority status, you know, because of Muslim dominated culture, you know, even, you know, only recently did women gain the ability to drive in Saudi Arabia. So we noticed that it's not a Western culture at all, although they enjoy the fruits of Western culture because they sell us all their oil, that kind of thing. But, I'm just saying, like, it just seems to me like, in the West, as things become more and more secularized, your generation is approaching people on a different level. Like the devil has sort of like labeled Christianity as intolerant, insensitive, and, you know, what is it? History. What is it? On the wrong side of history. Mm-hmm. Whereas we know that there wouldn't even really be like the kind of history that we have right now in terms of hospitality, medical, scientific discovery, if it wasn't for the release of people understanding the image of God and the creativity, the creation story, understanding what's going on. So, do you think you were 13 at that time, you're living, but you still have that. You said it was sort of easier, right? It was, you understood who you were.
Yes.
And the way you had to operate, right?
Yes. Like, I mean, my parents were very, very good. They were incredible teachers. I mean, they still are. But they distilled in me a very, clear guideline of how to spiritually operate, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, physically operate within the parameters that we had. I'm trying to ultimately answer your question.
I'm just saying, like, you lived like those first 13 years of your life. You're yes. living as like a, you're a Christian. You knew you were different.
Yes, that much is true. Yes. Like even, okay. Yes. I went to an Indian school, private school in Saudi Arabia where they taught the Indian curriculum. So like I was surrounded by other Indians, who were mostly Hindus and Muslims living in Saudi Arabia. And so me being the Christian out of the group, it was different. Like I genuinely was one or two out of a class of maybe 40 or 50 mm-hmm. who was the Christian. And so it was very interesting, like, trying to be a Christian, mm-hmm. Amongst them, because in this school, they would teach, Islam as a class. It was very interesting, like in grade three to have this teacher teach me the Quran. And I was like, what? I don't understand. Because in my view, like based on what my parents had taught me, it was like, no, the Bible is the truth. So it was like, mm-hmm. I'm being met with it, which it was fun, made for really interesting dialogue, like with the mm-hmm. teachers. Like they would talk about their version of heaven, and I would be counter with like, no, here's what the Bible says about heaven. So like that was interesting. But yeah, being a Christian in that environment, it truly like presented multiple opportunities where if we were to go back to like, you know, the devil's strategy, it's like, yeah, I could be derailed by, you know, what the teachers say or mm-hmm. because of my parents' testimony and example where they would read, they would pray and they would like have, you know, we would have times of prayer together as a family. Like it became my own faith and it wasn't like a parroted, like I wasn't a parrot of Christianity. Like I had my own walk. It was, you know, whatever walk a 13-year-old can have, you know, with that limited life experience. But I had this opportunity to develop the foundation for my faith and start to be confident in that no matter what strategies the devil may try to throw at me, mm-hmm. whether by way of my peers or my teachers back in Saudi Arabia, that I could defer to the Bible, defer to my walk with God, and be secure in that.
Mm. So there, yeah, so there were, you know, it could be that as, you know, as generations move on, that we don't live in a culture where Christian thinking is is like the status quo. It's like, we're, you know, and so we're battling an idea. And so you've been in that kind of culture. You grew up in a classroom like that. And so, you know, we know that Jesus was 12 and when he was, mystifying the leaders in the temple. So, I mean, don't dismiss what you learned from 2 to 12 or 2 to 13. And then you were a teenager in a, like you said, a very unregulated, unimpeded kind of internet stream. And then you got the whole other thing. You had to battle a different way. Yeah. So we're going to end this way here. There's a famous song again, Randy Stonehill, shut the door, keep out the devil.
Yeah.
I'm going to hit you with a couple of lines. Well, Satan is an evil charmer. What do we do?
Shut the door, keep out the devil.
There you go. He's hungry for a soul to hurt.
Shut the door,
keep out the devil. And without your holy armor,
shut the door, keep out the devil.
There you go. He will eat you for dessert. That's the way it goes.
That's amazing.
Keep the devil in the night. It's like, this is the kind of thing. I mean, I don't want to trivialize this. And I hope that we haven't done that, but I appreciate your experiences that I haven't had. So I don't know what it's like to be, an 11-year-old with Muslims, Hindus, and living in a culture that is totally, not totally anti-Christian. They want Christians to be Christians to the point where they can serve their Muslim kind of, you know, that's another whole discussion. Mm-hmm. But I do think like we've covered this point is like that, you know, the devil is really subtle.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes he's in your face, like mm-hmm. in a place like Saudi Arabia, that's in your face. But in other, you know, the subtle thing, the sneaking, the slithering serpent, right?
Yeah.
And
we used to sing that song, by the way. my parents back in Saudi Arabia. I have no idea how they'd get these songs, but I do remember Shut the Door, Keep Out the Devil.
Yeah, it's an older one. It's one of those older classic Christian things. I'm going back, like, you know, back to the, you know, one of the early Christian pioneers of contemporary music. One of their anthems was, "Why should the devil have all the good music?" So, I mean, this was like good music, you know, anyway. Yeah. But thanks, yeah, Anu.
Thank you.
Thanks, and hopefully we'll do something again. And friends, this has been the Grace Hour Show, a podcast from Greater Grace Church in Baltimore. If you're listening on any of these platforms, Spotify, Google, YouTube, wherever you're listening, you could give us a review. And we'd like you to give us a 5-star review, right? And yes, we'd like you to subscribe and be a part of our discussion group and listening. Thank you for some of those who are commenting there. We didn't go to the comments so much, but really, all week we'll be talking about the invisible war and how to be aware of what the strategy of hell is against us as believers. So for a new ire, I'm Pastor Steve Androlonis. Our engineer today has been Jehu Vandiver. So thank you for him, and have a great day, everyone.
Bye.
God bless you.